Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Cormac O'Hara. Will the government attempt to buy votes in the budget despite economic uncertainty? And the push for a four-day working week was launched this week. Is it too good to be true or a viable option? We'll have that and more, but first the news, read by Tommy Mescal. Thank you very much indeed, Tommy Mescal. Konnichiwa, agus brigade fáilte, muíochas libh a sochtéise, plin cúigi hín, cúigi cúig a hín, 51551 if you want to get in contact with us between now and 2 o'clock. Our panel today is Patrick O'Donovan, Fine Gael TD for Limerick County and Minister of State for Finance, Public Expenditure and Reform. He joins us from the Limerick studio. Thomas Byrne, Fianna Fáil TD for Meath East and spokesperson on education and skills. Jed Nash, Labour Senator and party spokesperson on employment and social protection. Dr. Mary McAuliffe is an historian and an assistant professor in gender studies at UCD. And Brenda Power is a Sunday Times and Irish Daily Mail columnist. As I say, 51551. You can also WhatsApp the programme, 087 187 9101. Can we clear something up, Minister Patrick O'Donovan? Talk yesterday from the Taoiseach about possible cuts to income tax, contrary to what the Minister for Finance had said previously. Reports today in the paper that Fine Gael is going after the family vote, trying to curry favour with families ahead of a possible general election. Is that what you're doing in the election or in the budget in a week and a half time? Going after votes?
No. Is a simple, straightforward answer. I spoke to the Minister for Finance yesterday and again this morning. And a lot of the reports in this morning's papers are, in his own words, you know, they're totally speculative because he's made no decisions on anything. And in fact, the bilateral meetings that he's having with outside organisations and government departments are still continuing. But one of the things that he has said, and he has reiterated it, and he said it time and time again, is that the budget is going to be on the basis of preparing Ireland for a no deal. Everybody knows that it's a €2.8 billion package and 2.1 is committed. But that's
No tax cuts then. I mean, the Fiscal Advisory Council not so long ago said, look, because of the unusual uncertainty, they said, we might have to raise taxes.
Well, look, I mean, the Minister for Finance raised taxes last year. He didn't raise personal income tax, but raised it elsewhere. So it's always open to the Minister for Finance if he wants to raise revenue for particular issues and particular
Again this time, a net increase.
Well, no, I mean, we're not saying that. I mean, the Minister has said that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. And actually, even speaking to him again this morning, he's been very clear and has been very clear throughout this. And, you know, it never fails to surprise me. Last year's budget was, you know, in the run-up to it. I was probably on this programme in the run-up to the last one as well, and we were probably going around with the same headlines that this was, last year's one was going to be an election one and it was going to be a giveaway one. The year before was because, you know, a lot of people that are commenting on this never gave this government much of a chance of surviving beyond one budget, let alone be going into four. So, look, I mean, every budget that has Pascal Donoghue has been introduced has been going into an election one, and that hasn't happened.
We're definitely going into an election now.
We are.
The person and the people giving this government a chance is Fianna Fáil. They're keeping you in power, Thomas Byrne. Would you put up with a decrease in income tax given the way things are so uncertain?
Well, look, first of all, we're not giving this government a chance, we're giving the country a chance, and we feel that the country needs the stability with the advent of Brexit, the strong possibility of a no-deal Brexit. Micheál Martin last December felt that the country needed this stability, and I think that's been proven now over recent months. I think it's time to remember that. We're no fans of this government, but we felt that an election wouldn't solve anything, wouldn't change much in the context of Brexit, and we're better off giving the country the stability that it needs to make sure that we can get the best possible outcome for Brexit. So that's what overshadows
the attempt to buy the family vote is the way Kevin Doyle and the Independent, I think, described it.
Well, look, you know, Fine Gael aren't going to do that. I mean, it's very convenient that Fine Gael spin doctors are pushing that message out when yesterday we had record childcare costs on the front of the newspaper.
They're going to tackle it. That's what they say in the reports. They've free GP care for under 8s, free dental for under 6s, investment in childcare, which you mentioned, and home care, and investment in education.
Look,
as well.
I mean, we're stabilising things in the country's interest, but like, it's a bit late for the government to start going on about how they're going to tackle these issues, tackling family costs when they've let them run riot in terms of housing, in terms of childcare and other particular issues. They had a plan, they've put it forward. It hasn't worked. Yesterday's headlines show that. We have a government of mixed messages. We have the Taoiseach talking about tax cuts. Last November at their party conference, there was record tax cuts being announced. The Taoiseach subsequently said, oh no, we'll emphasise services. Pascal Donoghue said, no, we can't have tax cuts. And then the Taoiseach said something different this week again.
Are you saying there should be no tax cuts whatsoever, given the fact that we have Brexit coming down the line in a few weeks' time, five weeks or less?
The most significant tax cuts have come in the last few years is the reduction to the USC, which was modest, but it did give families a break, which was our objective, and we put it into the conference supply agreement. And again, Fine Gael, at the time of the last general election, promised the complete abolition of the USC. Now, we said at the time it wasn't possible, and their figures unravelled before the election, as they're unravelling at the moment, it seems, in terms of the mixed messages.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, they don't seem to know. They don't seem to have a fixed strategy. Our strategy has been very, very clear. We want to put the emphasis on public services to try to improve them and to make sure that the money goes in there, while at the same time giving middle-income families a break. That's what we have done. In the context of Brexit, and particularly the possibility of a no-deal Brexit, the scope for tax cuts is extremely limited. And that's why we certainly, at the very least, raising our eyebrows at the various statements of the Taoiseach.
Right, would you agree with that, Jed Nash? It seems that the opposition are crying out for more investment in public services. But are you saying that the government isn't listening?
I don't think they are. They're still on the agenda of tax cuts. Well, in fact, the reality is that we don't believe that people necessarily want tax cuts. What people want is investment in public services that work, public services that are accountable, and public services that do what they say on the tin. If we're going to have an approach to the budget that is Brexit-proofed and or at least proofed against the worst excesses and worst vicissitudes of a no-deal Brexit, what we need to do is use the fiscal capacity that we have, that €700 million in headroom, because that's all realistically that the Minister for Finance has at play. We need to make sure that we protect low-income families and that we protect people who are on social welfare. And why do I say that? I say that because they are the people who are going to be worse off, and the people who are going to be disproportionately affected by the effects of a no-deal Brexit. We look at food prices going up, look at energy costs going up and so on. They are the people who need the protection. And there's an interesting debate going on at the moment between Fine Gael and those who are propping them up in government, Fianna Fáil, about the extent of any increases that might be proposed in terms of social welfare payments. We need to make sure that people on low incomes are proofed under poverty proofing.
But is there
around
there
the impact
to increase
of
welfare payments?
Well, there isn't. We're actually going to be proposing our own alternative budget next week, using the resources that we have available.
But is
insulate
money there? I wonder. What does insulate mean?
It means making sure that, for example, social welfare payments keep pace not only with increases in inflation but increases in wage growth. We're talking about around about a 3.5% increase anticipated in wage growth over the next years. We need to make sure that people have the
money
capacity.
Where does this money
come from? Well, it comes from the fiscal space that we have available. And
but
if we're all serious and if we can collectively agree
council,
in the political system.
The fiscal advisory council, as I said to the minister, they said things are unusually uncertain and we need to be possibly raising taxes. And you're talking about increasing welfare payments.
With the limited resources that we have available, there are also, as well, remember the prospect of actually trying to raise additional revenue by introducing new forms of wealth taxes, taxes on assets and so on, that this government has, generally speaking, failed to do and are not interested in doing.
Can I bring the minister back in there for 1 second and hammer this one? No way a supplementary budget. That's the line from government. Why not? What if things go really pear-shaped on Brexit?
Well, that's why we've set out the parameters for in the summer economic statement in relation to the difficulties that Ireland could be thrown into in a no-deal scenario. That's why the Department of Finance and the commentators around the summer economic statement all said that the parameters that we've laid out are within what could be expected to run to minus 1.5% of a deficit. So we are looking at the worst-case scenario and we're planning on that basis. And one of the things that we won't be doing, and we said this from the start, is we won't be getting into the space of promising to spend money that we don't have, like an out-of-control $4.5 billion for every 6 months of the year Fianna Fáil press office. We won't be doing that. €24 million a day in additional promises from Fianna Fáil. We won't be doing that. So we will be prudent, and we have done an awful lot of work over the last number of years.
A Fine Gael advisor said to me not so long ago, he said, look, I told him, he says, in Fine Gael at the last election that there was a push for investment in public services. But his words, not mine, they were too arrogant to listen. They went for the tax cuts and they were burned, he said.
Yeah, Dúirt Venn Lum go Dúirt Venn Lé.
Dúirt Fear Lum go Dúirt Fear Lé.
Yeah, yeah. Huh? Well, look, I mean...
Isn't that the truth of it, though?
Well, the truth of it is, you know, an unnamed source versus the Minister for Finance, Pascal Donoghue, this morning, we're not going to be... we're not going to throw around the hard-earned benefits of this economy in a fashion that was done between 2007 and 2009.
But hang on a second, did the Taoiseach himself...
Can I just finish?
Do you buy that line from the Minister? Let me throw it around the panel, just to finish one point.
The last time that we had any kind of economic growth in this country, current expenditure grew at four times economic growth. About 14% it grew at. Current day-to-day expenditure, completely unsustainable. We're in a space at the moment where current expenditure is running at or below the same level as economic growth, and that's where we're going to stay.
Brenda Power, do you buy that line, especially when you look at what the Taoiseach said days ago? There are lots of different ways to put money back in people's pockets, he says.
I have to say I was quite surprised at the definitiveness of the Taoiseach during the week when he ruled out the supplemental budget, because the reality is, Cormac, nobody knows what is going to happen. I agree with Jed. I do think that most people would prefer to see investment in services rather than a few euros on the tax cuts. And also, you know, when you talk about benefiting people on lower income, surely rather than the fiver or whatever negligible amount they might be going to get, take that money and invest it in services, the services that they rely on and they avail of.
Ruud Van Lees is the minister.
Yeah,
sure. How do we know people want money? Maybe they want money in their own pockets.
I genuinely don't believe that. I mean, when you look at the stress, for instance, or the burden that, for instance, childcare is on families, I think they would prefer to see some acknowledgement of that and some assistance with that rather than an extra fiver.
What do you think, Mary?
Well, as a non-politician and as a person who pays taxes into this economy, and I question the idea of economic growth and what do they mean by that and who's benefiting from that. And I look out of the city and there's cranes on the skylines everywhere, and then there are people sleeping on the streets every night of the week. So who's benefiting from this economy, and how is this government going to make sure that public services on housing, on education, on healthcare, and all the things they have been missing deadlines are going to be delivered without imposing tax increases?
A government would say a rising tide lifts all boats.
It does not. And we know that from the last Celtic Tiger who up and died. It does not. That is a fallacy. And I think they have to look at who is not benefiting in our economy now and look at those populations. Look at, you know, the high cost of childcare, high cost of home care, healthcare, all the different costs that are being borne by people who are not being paid enough, who are working in the gig economy, who are the working poor, basically, who are living in crisis accommodation or homelessness.
But the minister says they're looking at it.
Well, they've been looking at it for years now and nothing is happening.
Yeah, is that a fair point, Minister? I mean, we hear time and time again, as homeless figures, for example, go up and up and up, that yes, things aren't what we want them to be. That's what the government says, but we're working on it.
Look, one of the first things that you have to address any problem in terms of public expenditure is you have to have an exchequer, and the exchequer has to have receipts. In other words, there has to be people working to pay into them. There's 2.8 million people at work in Ireland at the moment, the largest number of people that had ever been at work. The policies that we brought in 2011 with the Labour Party and Jed and people like that was first and foremost to give people back the dignity of a day's work that had been stripped off of them by a government that threw the country under a bus.
Race to the bottom is what Michael Higgins called it.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, if you look at the number of people that are at work now, the tax receipts that those people contribute, we still have, this country is still massively indebted. We're still paying down huge levels of debt that were heaped on this country by another previous government. So the first thing that you need to have before you even set off on a spending agenda is you have to have the ability to spend. You have to have the ability to be able to resource all of the things that you want to do in health, in education, in housing, in everything else. And to do that, you need people that work in sustainable jobs.
I mean, but Patrick, the problem
and that's
is,
what we have.
The problem
we have
is,
the
Patrick.
Largest number of people now in this economy at work. And you know,
let in your friend.
I'll just finish very briefly. Can I just finish very briefly? One of the things that, I mean, everybody has faults with the current government, and we haven't said that we haven't made mistakes, we've acknowledged that. But one of the things that has to have been acknowledged is between 2011 and 2016, this economy was turned around faster than any other economy that hit an existential crisis to the extent that this one did. And that needs to be acknowledged.
Is that fair enough, Thomas Brown?
Well, look, I mean, the deal and the plan for that was put together at the end of the last Fianna Fáil government, actually. That's what happened. And yes, Fianna Fáil went out of office at that point. But what's happened, what the reason for that crash, or one of the main reasons, was the reliance on stamp duty, which was up on 20% of tax revenues, totally unsustainable. And what do we have now? We have corporation tax coming in close to 20% of revenues, and that is being used to cover up really huge spending commitments that the government is doing. So they're going on about that, Patrick, that we can raise the money, we have the money, but where is the money coming from? It's coming from corporation tax, which no one believes is going to be sustainable in the long run.
Mary, that's
the
difficulty.
Well, the Minister said we hit an existentialist crisis all those years ago when the Celtic Tiger died. It wasn't an existentialist crisis. It was a crisis created by bad politics, lack of oversight, lack of proper investment in the right places, lack of saving, giving too many tax cuts. And you know, I always appreciated tax cuts, but I also realised that if you cut too much, you can't pay for the services. And I look at the profession I'm in, the university sector, is tumbling down the rankings because this government won't invest properly in the future, in the education of the young people of this country who are going to be the ones that will be the workers. He talks about 2.8 million working. How many of them are working hand to mouth in the gig economy, hourly wages, barely on the minimum wage? They cannot. People working on that in Dublin cannot afford to live in Dublin.
Okay.
This is not an economy that is working for the majority.
Wrong, says Maureen, before I come to you, Jed Nash. I would prefer the extra fiver in my pocket. I'm a pensioner and every euro counts, she says. Ed says, Cormac, reducing taxes will stimulate the economy because it will encourage people to spend more, which in turn will generate more tax through VAT, etc. It's high tax taxation that kills the economy. Adrian says, is Jed Nash serious? Why not protect the middle class that pay the taxes? I'm sick of listening to talk about protecting social welfare recipients.
Well, we're all consumers of public services, okay? Whether your correspondent there accepts it or not. And a much more efficient way to actually use the quantum of money that we have available is by investing in home care packages, for example. And I know Thomas is in the same position as me. His constituency office, I'm sure, is inundated with calls from residents in the North East, from Louth in my case, and from Meath East and Thomas' case, around home care packages, dealing with so many people. Really, people put to the pin at our collar trying to care for very ill relatives and people with disabilities. That's not the kind of society that we want to live in. Everybody benefits from better public transport, from better home care packages, better education systems. So we need to be smart about how we invest those resources.
Okay.
Investing, well, we'll see. You know, cutting tax to the tune of, you know, the price of a cup of coffee for a middle income earner is not an efficient use of public resources.
Look, we'll have more talk about what could happen in the budget between now and budget day, but let's move on. 51551. Gerard says, I'm absolutely fed up with every politician blaming everything on Brexit. It's disingenuous and an insult to the electorate. Everything now that's in this budget will be blamed on bloody Brexit. Using this as an excuse has to stop. Nobody is being fooled, says Gerard. We're all quite civil, I must say, in the debate so far, Brenda Power. I'm seeing here coming through in reports that Boris Johnson could face a confidence vote next week. By God, how will that debate go? Because the debate in Westminster during the week was divisive. It may lead to societal unrest and hate and attacks on politicians and so on. But I wonder, is this chickens coming home to roost for traditional style politics and politicians? And you could say the same about this country, could you not?
Oh God, I don't know, Cormac. I think last week's scenes in the House of Commons were unprecedented. And I genuinely found them disturbing and quite shocking. That humbug comment that he made to Jess Phillips, I think, after she had outlined the very real concerns, you know, prompted by the murder of Joe Cox not 3 years ago, by someone shouting Britain First, when she had outlined those legitimate concerns and linked them to the language, and we know that, you know, inflammatory language is extremely dangerous and corrosive. For him to sit back with his artfully tousled hair and say, "Oh, such humbug," I thought I was genuinely shocked by that. I'm.
But the politicians who were hopping up and down.
Which always seems to be a feature of debate in the House of Commons, actually, much more than it is.
Yeah, but they use divisive language themselves, don't they?
Yeah, but there's a difference between divisive language, which is, you know, a part of the cut and thrust, I would say, of political debate, and downright name calling, and also cavalier attitude to genuine concerns about safety. I mean, especially women's safety. And I do believe that Boris Johnson is an absolute unreconstructed misogynist. This is a man who considers the word girly to be an insult. Your big girl's blouse, your girly swat. So, you know, to have him in the position he is in, apart from anything else, apart from his irresponsibility, apart from his dishonesty, apart from his mendacity, you know, to see that complete disregard for the well-being and the lives, the safety of some of his members of parliament, you know, has to be a poisonous precedent.
Mary, we were watching agog here. Everybody in the country, in one way, the political class, the commentariat, punters generally. But I come back to the point, adversarial politics leads to enraged or passionate debate, and things are said sometimes that are wrong, and it happens everywhere, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, yeah, we've seen name calling in the Dáil, but I've never seen anything like the House of Commons. I've seen Trump use incendiary language similar to what Boris Johnson used last week, and Trump's language, we can agree, has emboldened white supremacists quite dangerously so, in fact murderously so, as we've seen with several mass murders that have happened. And this morning I saw on social media Nigel Farage talking about how post-Brexit the civil servants will take a knife to them. I mean, you can't use that sort of language. But it goes.
And Brendan O'Neill, a commentator, called for riots.
Called for riots, yes, I saw that. Yes, he said.
But do you think that's
that actually they should riot in the street? And I mean, politicians can get angry, politicians can get passionate about what they're defending or what they're trying to get their, or getting their points across. But you don't dismiss real threats to life and limb, real death threats. And I mean, when the women politicians in particular were talking about Joe Cox and the fact that they are getting death threats daily into their offices, particularly the women like Jess Phillips or Yvette Cooper, and he laughed at them and said, "Humbug."
And that's a step too far. But my point, Jed, is that this is chickens coming home to roost for traditional style politicians or establishment politicians who use, to use a better term, for want of a better term, passionate language, which actually sows adversary and hatred too.
I'm not that sure. I mean, there's a difference between robust debate that's informed by your philosophical and principled policy viewpoint. This is actually by design. And this is what is, I think, should be concerning to all of us. There's been a toxification of language, toxification of the political culture in the UK. It's not a case now that you're defined by whether you're left or right or centre or liberal, conservative or Labour. You're either pro-Remain or you're pro-Brexit. And that has really kind of ossified the political environment in the UK. I mean, I was over at the Labour Party conference with my colleague, the party leader, Brendan Howland, and other Labour Party colleagues this week, and we had some very productive engagement with our colleagues over there. And thankfully now the UK Labour Party has a defined position in terms of its viewpoint on its horizon in the context of Brexit.
It is not the leader, though.
It is now.
Well, before we come to that, what about the language used at the party conference? I mean, there was passion there for sure, wasn't there?
Absolutely, and you would expect to see that at party conferences where people who are, you know, party activists, people who are really motivated by their political views, and they'll have that debate internally within the party, and that, I think, is a good thing. But what we're seeing here at the moment is, I think, what happened really in that, and I don't want to over-egg this, but I think it's true. The late 1920s into the 1930s, the kind of language that's been used that gave rise to the rise of fascism, that is extremely dangerous.
Boris Johnson himself, David Lammy, that called Brexiteers worse than Nazis.
I can't recall that particular comment, and he's not here to defend his comments.
But that's exactly my point.
Absolutely, in the heat of debate. No, it cannot be,
if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. And you tone down politics and language and toxicity on all sides. You can't just jump on Boris Johnson because you hate him.
This has been done by design. This is the point. And remember what Brexit is. Brexit is a kind of a right-wing fantasy. It involves the bonfire of regulation, of workers' rights, of environmental regulations, a kind of free market UK on steroids that's going to be able to do its own trade deals, become a country that is just absolutely addicted to no regulation, torches everything, and that's not in the interest of... This is really existential kind of stuff here.
When Eamon Gilmore used the word treason in relation to a former Fianna Fáil leader in Taoiseach, that was by design as well.
That may be a comment that, knowing Eamon as I do, he would have considered that extremely carefully. Remember, this country was in the throes of an existential threat at the time.
What's the difference between that and betrayal?
No. There has been a series, and there's been an environment that's been created in the UK that has allowed all of this to happen in a very, very, in a way that's done by design. That's been consistent.
Eamon Gilmore at the time said it was deliberately done to try to gain votes. And when Eamon Gilmore got into government, I think he saw that things weren't quite so simple as he saw them in opposition. And I think that's why it's very important that we moderate language, that we moderate policy to the extent to promise what's deliverable rather than what's not deliverable. Your caller initially, you talked about, you know, blaming Brexit for everything. Brexit is a serious threat to this country, and I think most people know that. The ESRI said it could plunge the country into recession next year. So that's why we took this view last December. We need to be as moderate as possible. We need as much stability as possible. Tone everything down in terms of these kind of words being thrown across at politics. And, you know, look to the UK and see, well, that's not how we're going to do things here. But unfortunately, we can look in. It has a profound effect on this country. But we cannot let that start. I mean, you're talking about the bonfire of the old system or whatever. I mean, the old system is democracy. And I don't think that we can allow that to go on a bonfire. I think we have to protect that at all costs. And that will require at times, you know, robust policy-based debates. But we cannot allow this to continue. But the
argument that Boris Johnson is relying on at the moment is it's Boris and the people versus the establishment.
Yeah, he went to Eton. I don't know how much more establishment he can get.
He's a signed up member of the elite.
How can Boris Johnson, and the same with Donald Trump, who inherited over 300 million, be a man of the people? It always bemuses me that he positions himself as that. But what is more interesting as well is in his relationship with Europe. He's talking about Britain as if it was a colony. I mean, this was the biggest empire of the contemporary history, of modern history, and they are regarding themselves as a colony. And he's using war terms, he's using violent terms about the withdrawal from Europe. And it's what it's doing is it's rising up violence in the street, racism, people being told to go back to where they came from. If you're French or Spanish or, God help us, if you're, you know, from Africa, you're absolutely facing into horrendous racism. Misogyny, sexism, all of those things have been increased because they have been allowed. And when you see the Prime Minister using that sort of language, what's to stop everybody else?
But every leader minister wants to be on the side of the people who get up early in the morning, don't they?
Yeah, well, look, to go back to the question that was used about language, I think we had an element of it in our own parliament as well, remember, in the not too distant past.
Go on.
Where you had a Minister for Justice, and Taoiseach, who was basically hounded out of her job, hounded out of her role by a quasi-kangaroo court with hooping and hollering in the Dáil Bar. And then when the kangaroo court was found...
The Minister resigned.
Can I finish a pint?
Go on, yeah.
When the hooping and hollering died down, and when the kangaroo court was set to one side, it was shown that the Minister for Justice in question did no wrong. But the person who led the charge against that Minister for Justice and who led the hooping and hollering has still to apologise to that woman.
What kangaroo court are you talking about?
I'm talking about a kangaroo court that demanded that Frances Fitzgerald be ran out of the job that she was doing on a trumped-up charge inside in the Dáil without any...
Are you calling the Dáil and parliamentary holding to account a kangaroo court?
No, but what I am...
This is no similar to what Boris Johnson...
Will you ask me a question?
Why not prorogue the Dáil then?
Well, you're just asking me a question. I don't call the Dáil that. I value the Dáil and
I respect
the Dáil.
What did you call the kangaroo court then?
What I call a kangaroo court. If you'd let me finish. Can I finish? Carmack, there isn't much point in asking me. There really isn't much point in asking me. What I call the kangaroo court is a group of people, self-appointed, within the Dáil, who decided that they were judge, jury and executioner of a Minister
Nobody
for Justice
was self-appointed
without any evidence. And then, when it came to pass that that former Minister for Justice was actually wronged by the treatment that she had been that was doled out her by that kangaroo court, the same protagonists in that court are still yet to be men enough to apologise to her.
Sorry, I mean, look, first of all, the previous Minister for Justice is bizarrely looking for an apology from Fine Gael because he was sacked by a Fine Gael Taoiseach. Frances Fitzgerald was asked to resign by a Fine Gael Taoiseach. Every politician, myself, if you don't get enough votes, there's no Employment Appeals Tribunal for a TD, you lose the election. And in Dáil Éireann, if the minister, and this is you too, Patrick, and the arrogance needs to stop from Fine Gael, if a minister loses the confidence of the Dáil, for whatever reason, there is no Employment Appeals Tribunal, you lose your job. That's the democracy that we have. This is democracy. And I think you should go and ask the Taoiseach why he asked Frances Fitzgerald.
I'll hear Mary and Brenda very quickly and then.
To language and the language that was doled out at the time.
Sorry, I think what the minister is misunderstanding is the rough and tumble of politics and shenanigans that do go on and all sorts of intrigue like that, and the difference between that and using incendiary language to rile up the population and to rile up people to acts of violence.
Look, people are still talking about taxes. By text, I need to take a break, but I read one from our listener. Absolutely raise taxes. Healthcare is overloaded. Housing is in dire conditions. We need money to invest in resources. If there's a tax cut, I'll be saving money. Says that listener. 51551. We'll be back with a 4-day working week after the break.
Email saturday@rte.ie. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
You're welcome back. I'm with Minister Patrick O'Donovan of Fine Gael, Thomas Byrne of Fianna Fáil, Jed Nash of Labour, Dr. Mary McAuliffe and Brenda Power. And Brenda Power, what do you make of this campaign that was launched a day or two ago about the 4-day working week? Is it possible? Because they say it's possible with no loss of productivity and the same pay.
Well, obviously it depends on the industry and the business you're talking about. Apparently the model upon which this is based was first taken up by a New Zealand company. I think they're a tech company. And the boss of that company said he had read that apparently people in specific industry, now we're not talking about people on whose work is kind of time dependent or based on time, but who's productivity based, that they're really only productive for 2.5 hours a day. So the rest of the time they're faffing around the water cooler and talking about last night's television. So his motivation was, well, let's see if we can compress that 2.5 hours into 4 days rather than 5. He's saving time, obviously saving money with regard to having people on staff and in his office. There's all kinds of benefits with regard to commuting and emissions and so on. So there are definitely some businesses in which it'll work. But interestingly, Cormac, here's the thing that struck me about his experience. Mm. When he introduced it in his company, only 2/3 of the employees went for it. So
why?
Clearly, I don't know. Obviously, 1/3 of them were going, no thanks, I'd rather be in work.
Maybe they were working a 3-day week and they didn't want to go up to 4. That'd be it.
Or they found they'd be working properly at home, wouldn't get away with doing 2.5 hours.
Is it a runner, Jed Nash, I wonder here?
It absolutely is realistic. I've been looking at this very closely in the context of work I'm doing on behalf of the Labour Party, the future of work and how we redesign how we work and how we become more productive. And actually, this is what this is about. It's about maintaining the profitability and competitiveness of companies and firms and organisations, but at the same time making sure that people can work for fewer hours, actually be at the desk for fewer hours, but be as productive as they are. Because, I mean, there are huge challenges at the moment in terms of childcare, in terms of quality of life, work-life balance, anxiety and stress from the workplace. People who have to be at a desk at a certain time of the day and have to leave at another time of the day. And we're always on, and this is the point. I'm looking very closely at the moment of what they did in France in 2016. They actually now have a legal right to have expressed in their contract the right to disconnect. So in other words, you leave work and you actually switch off.
But they're trying to roll back with great difficulty now in France under Macron the 35-hour working week, aren't they?
Apparently, the French government are looking at that, but I would imagine that this would be resisted very heavily
by those
in France who have actually value the fact that there's a good society in which to work, a good society in which to live and to raise a family. So I'm going to commend Forza Trade Union actually for leading the charge on this. And I've been working with representatives of that union and indeed business people as well to look at actually how we can do this over a period of time. This is actually about transitioning how we work over a period of time.
I've actually worked
with a company in Louth, my own constituency, who actually came to me recently because I've been talking about this, saying, look, we did this last year, it works very, very well indeed. Their productivity is up, their bottom line is up, people are happier. And actually what they invest a lot of money in training, for example, it's much easier to retain staff now because what they don't want is obviously to lose staff to competitors. So if one organisation engages in the four-day week and the prospect is that, well, if you're going to move to a competitor that actually works on the basis of a five-day week, you want to value that four-day week job.
But also, the point I was going to make when you mentioned that, say, a 35-hour working week, we are talking really at cross purposes, because there you still have the people presumably doing the 2.5 hours of useful work in that time. It's more about productivity. It's more about compressing, you know, that work and incentivizing that work being compressed into less time. Obviously, it's not going to work for people who have to be at their desks from 9 to 5 or who have to be on duty, say, as a guard or a nurse or whatever. But if you have a task that can be completed in less time within the working week, then why shouldn't you be able to go home when you're done? And you see, this week too, I think it was it Aaron Rod Aaron or was it Bus Aaron who came out and said, could you possibly stagger your working hours so that we don't have a glut of people? I mean, when you see the queues on the M50 some morning, surely a little bit of lateral thinking in some offices would ease this.
I can't resist asking Thomas Byrne, could you compress your 2.5 hours of productivity a day into 4 days a week?
I think any of these particular laws, they don't tend to bring them in for TDs or senators. Parental leave legislation, Fianna Fáil brought that in originally in 98, and then the Social Democrat opposition bill expanded it this year, and we facilitated them with time in the Shannon to support that and get that through.
What about small business people, though, who say, look, geez, I couldn't do this.
That is obviously a serious consideration, but it has to be said as well that a lot of small business people do, at cost to themselves, show great flexibility to workers. And not everybody, but there are people out there who are good employers and who do good jobs and are understanding of people, and if someone gets the job done, you know, people have flexible hours.
Would Fianna Fáil support a 4-day week?
Well, it's certainly something that you could certainly consider, but this is a dream that's not going to come in anytime soon. Working hours have decreased over time, and it may well be that they will decrease. My concern would be that, and I think Brendan might have touched on this, the companies still need to get products out. So that, I mean, do they need a lot more work done in the time?
But New Zealand, the business person from New Zealand said during the week, there is no loss of productivity. That's the point Brendan's made.
In fact, what he said is productivity has gone up. But I mean, he actually reckons, even though he doesn't have the data in front of him this week, that. Remember, this has been actually academically assessed as well by experts.
For a lot of people, it would be a dream, to have a 4-day week. Absolutely.
But
and I would welcome that for them. What I'm saying is not something you bring in immediately. I mean, there's only two ways of increasing productivity on reduced hours. One is automation, and the other is actually getting workers to do more in that time. And that's the choice we might have to make.
Getting workers to work smart. Yeah. Because a 5-day week, 8-hour day, how many of those hours are you actually not doing that much work at all? Also, it is very good for women. It would really help with the kind of gender gap in terms of pay and in terms of who's doing the caring duties. It's very good for the environment. I was reading that, there'd be less emissions, less cars on the road. I don't see that there's anything too wrong with this. And you have to remember, the way we work has changed over the centuries. We have not always been working in the same way. So we're now in the new technological revolution rather than the industrial revolution. And this really should allow us to work more smart,
absolutely.
Really, and to work like this and to compress our productivity.
So let me ask the Minister, are you on this one, the 4-day working week, Minister, are you on the side of the 2.8 million people who you say are working today, or the business people who propel jobs and growth?
Well, there isn't a difference, because without one, you don't have the other.
That's true.
I mean, you can't have employment unless you have employers.
But there's a divergence in terms of employers generally and employees in terms of the 4-day working week.
Not necessarily. And I think, from a government's point of view, one of the things that we've been focused on, and we published our future action plan for jobs, and I think one of your previous contributors mentioned it there. I think it was Brenda said, it's about the where we work and it's going to be about what we work as and, you know, the journey times of how we're going to make sure that our carbon footprint and things like that are managed into the future. And I mean, there's jobs that haven't even been created yet that are going to be done in the next 10 or 15 years. When my children, for instance, come to work, they certainly won't be doing jobs that are being done at the moment, or certainly the jobs that they'll be doing won't yet have been invented. But there's another group of people that have to be remembered in this, and that's the self-employed and SMEs. You know, they don't have the luxury of a five-day week in many cases. I mean, if you're working as self-employed, 7 days is probably, for a lot of people, is as much the norm as it is for 5 days
in the That's the divergence I mentioned. Yeah, IBEC have reservations about this. Do you also, I suppose?
Well, I suppose like what we want to try and do is to be make sure that, first of all, that we don't risk anything that's going to undermine the labour force. I mean, we already have labour shortages in this country in a number of different skills areas, and the lads in the panel will know that, and the ladies in the panel will know that as well. We've had to issue, for instance, you know, work permits for a whole range of work-related matters that we've shortages of in the economy at the moment. So whether or not we're going to have that into the future, I don't know. But I mean, the future action plans for jobs and things like the Disruptive Technologies Fund that we have brought out as a government, we're mindful of the fact that we have to keep pace with industry as well as society. And in my own role in the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, you know, we want to empower our own public servants, for instance, to make sure that they're given the opportunity either through continuous professional development, back to education opportunities that they have as well as public servants, that their role is going to change, because change management in the public or private sector is always going to be difficult to manage.
If you listen to Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil in this panel, this four-day working week is not going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, well, it's a it's a priority for the Labour Party to actually look at how we work. We are the party of work. We're the movement that brought you the weekend. We want to look now at how we can actually make sure that the working week now adequately kind of accommodates new ways of working and takes advantage of the tech that we have available to us now. We haven't actually had a conversation about working time in this country since the mid-1990s. Mm. That was pre-internet. It was pre-social media, the forms of AI that we're developing now at the moment, which are really exciting.
That's
really
your slogan for
the
election.
About
Vote Labour,
but it's a three-day weekend party. It's actually about making sure that the tech works for us and that we're not enslaved by it. We need to be liberated by the tech that we have to enjoy our lives and make sure that we work.
To interject there, it was actually the women laundry workers who went on strike in the mid-1940s that gave us the two-week holiday.
That's
so
right.
Work has always changed, but also we have to think of something else, which is work-life balance. I mean, we're not workers only. We are actually human beings who need to have some free time in our lives, time for hobbies, time for further education, time with families. So a four-day week without losing productivity and without losing any wages would be a very good
thing. Quick break, but
look, I mean, the truth is we want more flexibility. That's why we've expanded parental leave in Fianna Fáil, but the problem is broadband at home at the moment. People don't have it. So there's a lot of people who could work from home as part of their whatever day week they have can't do it because simply the government hasn't taken broadband seriously enough. I think we've got to be more concerned with automation in general, and I think that needs to be a focus as well. The other point to make is that, you know, France has reduced working hours, but I mean, you can't go to a restaurant outside of eating times in France. You can't go to a shop on a Sunday by and large, same in Germany. So there are less opportunities for people to work in those countries, whereas we in this country, I think in the UK, demand that things be open almost 24/7 at this
day. A texter says, we talk about how AI may eliminate many jobs. We don't have enough work for everyone to be working 5 days. Do we want increased unemployment and unhappy workers, or high employment and more leisure time? And one second for a cheap dig here. The Dáil is a great example of the four-day week and 3 months holidays. We'll talk history after the break.
Email saturday@rte.ie. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
If they can compress their work into 4 days, they weren't working hard enough, says Brendan, a mechanic who says he's still working Saturday. Well done to you, Brendan. Can I ask you, Thomas Byrne of Fianna Fáil, you're the education spokesperson, about this NCCA, the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment, review about history in the junior cert cycle. They say it should remain optional. Now, the Minister for Education could overrule that and make it compulsory. Should he or or shouldn't they?
Oh, if I'm Minister for Education and Fianna Fáil is in the Department of Education after the next election, it will be overruled. It's not that it's overruled. The NCCA don't have that power. Mm-hmm. The NCCA are curriculum advisors. Rory Quinn and Jan O'Sullivan, I think, abolished history as a compulsory requirement of the junior cert. Fine Gael have continued with that policy. It was announced really last November, but actually all we got was a review. Look, it has to go back as compulsory. Most kids do it, but we are starting to see some slippage because it's so important to learn about history. I mean, we believe that it is a core subject for junior certificate. And we, by the way, we had this in our manifesto at the last general election. It was identified by us at that time. Thankfully, now we've been raising it for some time. It has become the Fine Gael, obviously, cottoned on to that. This is a popular thing to do that they would say, rather than having a consistent philosophy, which is what we have. We think that it is important in itself to do. But it seems to have come a cropper, and I'm asking the Minister really to do his job under the Education Act, which is to decide what subjects that children learn. I'm not asking him to decide the content of the curriculum. That's the NCCA's job. What I am asking him to do is make sure that it is compulsory along with geography at junior studies.
And Mary, as an historian, you're going to say absolutely it should be optional.
Absolutely it should be core. I can't believe that they suggested that it remain optional. I mean, the thing is, with history, we need to know our history. If you look at what is happening in the world today, and you look even at the reaction of Brexiteers in Britain to the fact that Ireland has become an issue in their Brexit journey, they can't understand it because they never learnt about the colonisation that Britain did around the world. And if they did learn about it, it was the great imperial adventure, and sure, didn't they bring civilisation and Christianity and trains and things like that to the natives and all the lands they conquered. And
I mean, that idea... Shouldn't the study of philosophy and critical thinking be core? And that would get around that problem, because if you were elevated to a position of minister, you'd work out what the problems are.
Well, philosophy should also be there. But with history, we have to understand our own history, how our society came into being, the trauma, things that happened in our history, the idea that of history as progression is not valid, the ideas that things can be lost as well as gained throughout the historical narrative. We should know all of this, and having kids come up to school not understanding anything about the famine or the revolution or the Elizabethans or the Cromwellians is extraordinary. It also means there is slippage. There will be slippage. Schools will stop offering history because it is it's a heavy subject. It requires a lot of investment and a lot of teaching.
That doesn't fit in, though, with the school system, the education system that we're propelling now. It's all about points, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a history graduate at UCD, so I think Mary would expect me to be supportive of ensuring that history is compulsive. I took issue with the decision that was taken a number of years ago. I thought it was wrong-headed. I think it was ill-informed. I mean, I think our education system at the moment, while it is good, and it's credit to our teachers, all education staff, parents, and all other stakeholders in education, it is still, we have objectively a very good education system. My fear now, and it's not just, it doesn't just go back to schools, but universities as well, we're just creating kind of employees now, people who are ready for a particular kind of jobs market. And history is so important in terms of encouraging us to think critically, to analyse. Now, it is good that the CSPE element of our curriculum has been enhanced over the last few years, and
Let me put that point to the Minister. Are we educating people, Minister, now in the system, or are we educating, readying workers for multinational companies?
I'm kind of between both, really, to be honest about it. And I suppose, look, I was a teacher myself before I went into politics, and one of the things I'm not a fan of rote learning. I'm not a fan of just vomiting something down onto a page and for your Leaving Cert, and your Leaving Cert basically, or your Junior Cert being, rather than a test of how you feel about something, rather than how much you can remember and how quickly you can write. I don't think in 2019 that's a fair reflection, and I think an awful lot of students, and I go into schools a lot of times, take issue with that and far more. I mean, if you look at primary level and how the primary curriculum and the NCCA, by the way, you know, I think they need to be given space. They've made a recommendation, the minister's going to decide it. But if you look at how the primary school curriculum is structured and how children are active in their own learning, and then you look at the third level where you have the same, where the students are encouraged to go away and you know, learn for themselves, and wedged in between the middle you have this assessment based on regurgitation. And I think that's really, for me, is a critical thing. But
I have too little time.
One point in relation to history, and I would be cautious, because back in 2007, you know, a minister interfered in the history curriculum when she went off and ordered 2,000 books of Eamon de Valera. And I think that's something that we shouldn't be encouraging.
That was the very first point. One of the points I made is that the minister shouldn't be interfering with the curriculum. That's a fundamental principle which I've outlined in the Dáil. But look, I mean, I don't think we should denigrate the acquisition of knowledge to the extent that Patrick has. Both are important, acquiring knowledge, but also, you know, using the skills that to acquire knowledge. But what's happening at the moment in junior cycle is, and the danger is, that in relation to history, all that would happen would be a very small, minor project, perhaps on local history, which is important in itself, but you need that broad knowledge and those broad skills as well to acquire more knowledge.
Unfortunately, I do think, you know, when the minister talks there about learning subjects in order to vomit them back out, that very much, as far as I can see, is the nature of the model that is being applied now, particularly for Leaving Cert. And, you know, I was in New York during the summer, brought my 17-year-old son, who was doing his history for his Leaving Cert, to the Holocaust Museum, and he was astonished to see artefacts, for instance a children's book from the 1930s that described Jews as poison mushrooms, to see them in reality. And it suddenly took, you know, the stuff he had been learning simply to regurgitate and put it in context, and it was a dramatic sort of eye-opening moment to see these people are not being taught this subject for the love of it or for the benefit of it, but simply just as a means to an end.
You have the final word. A huge number of texts. Thank you very much, Anita. I'm way over, I'm so sorry. Class is over. Muihasla, Patrick O'Donovan and Tala, Thomas Byrne, Fianna Fáil, Jed Nash Labour, Dr. Mary McAuliffe and Brenda Power, back next Saturday at 1 o'clock. Until then, Slán.
The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan. The researcher was A.B. Philbin Bowman. Andrew Kane was on sound. And Saturday with Cormac O'Hara was produced by Tom Donnelly.